and concluded, "You are sailing in New Zealand waters, and if there was no dereliction on your part, as you say, then it's very possible that you will be entitled to lay claim to those funds." He had done his research well. Carver nodded, seeming impressed. "Anyway," Gascoigne said, sensing that the seeds of curiosity had been adequately sowed, "you ought to look into it. You might save yourself a great deal of money." He turned his cigarette over in his hand, examining its ember, to give Carver a chance to look him over unobserved. "What's your stake in this?" said Carver presently.
"None whatsoever," said Gascoigne. "As I told you, I work for the magistrate's court."
"You've got a friend in P&I, maybe?"
"No," Gascoigne said, "I don't. That's not the way it works, as I've told you."
He flicked the end of his cigarette onto the rocks below the beacon.
"You're just a man who tells another man about loopholes."
"I suppose I am," Gascoigne said.
"And then strolls away."
Gascoigne lifted his hat.
"I shall take that as my cue," he said.
"Good afternoon, Captain
Carver,"
said the former captain, shaking Gascoigne's hand very firmly this time.
"Frank Carver's my name."
"And I'm Aubert Gascoigne,"
Gascoigne reminded him with a pleasant smile. "I can be found at the courthouse, should you ever need me."
"Well, good luck with Godspeed."
"All right," Carver said.
"She really is a marvellous craft."
Gascoigne, strolling away, felt a kind of dawning wonder at himself. He kept his face forward and did not look back, knowing that Carver's dark eyes had followed him down the spit and around the edge of the quay and all the way to the southern end of Revel Street, where he turned the corner and disappeared from view. Sukyong Sheng, en route to Canyere to seek an interview with his compatriot Kui Long, was at that moment very deep in thought, his hands locked behind his back, his eyes fixed sightlessly upon the ground before him. He hardly registered the figures he passed along the roadside, nor the laden dray carts that clattered by, nor the infrequent riders making for the gorge, every man hatless and in shirt sleeves, enjoying the pale summer sun that seemed, for its rarity, to shine with a providential, good-hearted light. The mood along the Canyere Road was merry. Through the trees there came occasionally a snatch of a hymn, sung unaccompanied and in unison, from one of the makeshift chapels at the inland camps. Ah Suk paid no attention. His reunion that morning with Lydia Greenway, now Lydia Wells, had deeply unsettled him, and as a kind of conciliation to his unrest, he was replaying his own history in his mind, narrating the very same tale, in fact, that he had related to Ah Kui 3 weeks ago. When Francis Carver had first made his introduction to the Suk family, he had been but 21, and Ah Suk, as a boy of 12, had very naturally looked up to him. Carver was a terse and brooding young man, born in Hong Kong to a British merchant trader and raised at sea. He was fluent in Cantonese, though he cherished no love for China, and meant to leave that place as soon as he acquired a ship of his own, an ambition he referenced very frequently. He worked for the Guangzhou branch of the merchant firm Dent & Co., of which his father was a high-ranking official, and he was responsible for overseeing the transfer of Chinese wares to and from the export warehouses along the Pearl River. One of these warehouses was owned by Sukyong Sheng's father, Suk Chun Yuen. Sukyong Sheng understood very little about the financial operations of his father's business. He knew that the Suk warehouse served as a liaison point for buyers, the majority of which were British merchant firms. He knew that Dent & Co. was by far the most illustrious and well-connected of these firms, and that his father was very proud of this association. He knew that his father's clients all paid for their wares in silver ore, and that this was a further point of pride for Suk Chun Yuen. He knew also that his father hated opium, and that he held the imperial commissioner, Lin Tse-su, in very high esteem. Ah Suk did not know the significance of any of these particulars, but he was a loyal son, and he accepted his father's beliefs without comment, trusting them to be both virtuous and wise. In February 1839, the Suk warehouse was targeted for an imperial investigation. A fairly routine procedure, but a dangerous one. For under Commissioner Lin's decree, any Chinese merchants harbouring opium faced the penalty of death. Suk Chunyuan welcomed the imperial forces into his warehouse cordially, where they discovered, hidden amongst the tea, some 30 or 40 crates of opium resin, each weighing roughly 50 pounds. Suk Chunyuan's protestations came to nothing. He was executed without trial, and at once. Ah Suk did not know what to believe. His natural trust in his father's honesty prompted him to believe that the man had been framed, and his natural trust in his father's acumen made him doubt that the man could have been framed. He was in two minds, but he had no time to contemplate the matter, for within a week of the execution, war broke out in Guangzhou. Fearing for his own safety and for the safety of his mother, who had been driven near to madness with grief, Ah Suk turned to the only man he knew to trust, the young delegate from Dent & Co., Francis Carver. It transpired that Mr. Carver was more than happy to take on the Suk family business as a holding and to accept all burdens of organization and management upon himself, at least, he said, until Ah Suk's grief had run its course and the civil wars had quieted or resolved themselves.